at his red-streaked palm and then across at me, then shook his head in disbelief. I grinned weakly, riding the adrenaline surge that seeing his blood spilled had given me, and raised both my own hands in an expectant gesture.
"Come on, you asshole,"
it croaked out of my damaged mouth.
"Put me away."
He was on me almost before the last word left my mouth. This time I hardly touched him. Most of it happened beyond conscious combat. The Nurikem weathered the battering valiantly, throwing out blocks to keep the knuckles off me, and gave me the space for a couple of randomly generated counter-strikes that Envoy Instinct told me might get through Cadman's fighting pattern. He rode the blows like the attentions of an irritating insect. On the last of these futile ripostes, I overreached the punch, and he snagged my wrist, yanking me forward. A perfectly balanced roundhouse kick slammed into my ribs, and I felt them snap. Cadman pulled again, locked out the elbow of my captured arm, and in the frozen frames of Nurikem's speeded vision, I saw the forearm strike swinging down toward the joint. I knew the sound it was going to make when the elbow exploded, knew the sound I was going to make before the Nurikem could lock the pain down. My hand twisted desperately in Cadman's grip, and I let myself fall. Slippery with sweat, my wrist pulled free and my arm unlocked. Cadman hit with bruising force, but the arm held, and by then I was on my way to the floor anyway. I came down on the injured ribs, and my vision flew apart in splinters. I twisted, trying to fight the urge to roll into a fetal ball, and saw Cadman's borrowed features 1,000 meters above me.
"Get up," he said, like vast sheets of cardboard being torn in the distance. "We're not finished yet."
I snapped up from the waist, striking for his groin. The blow was out, spending itself in the meat of his thigh. Almost casually, he swung his arm, and the power knuckles hit me in the face. I saw a scribble of multicolored lights, and then everything whited out. The noise of the crowd ballooned my head, and behind it I thought I could hear the maelstrom calling me. It all cycled in and out of focus, dip and whirl like a graph drop, while the Nurikem fought to keep me conscious. The light swooped down and then back to the ceiling, as if concerned to see the damage that had been done to me, but only superficially and easily satisfied. Consciousness was something in wide elliptical orbit around my head. Abruptly, I was back on Sharya, holed up in the wreck of the disabled spider tank with Jimmy DeSoto.
"Earth?"
His grinning blackout-striped face is flash-lit by laser fire from outside the tank.
"It's a shithole, man. Fucking frozen society, like stepping back in time half a millennium. Nothing happens there. Historical events aren't allowed."
"Bullshit." My disbelief is punctuated by the shrill scream of an incoming marauder bomb. Our eyes meet across the gloom of the tank cabin. The bombardment has been going on since nightfall. The robot weapons hunting on infrared and motion track. In a rare moment when the Sharyan jamming went down, we've heard that Admiral Cursiter's IP fleet is still light seconds out, fighting the Sharyans for orbital dominance. At dawn, if the battle isn't over, the locals will probably put down ground troops to flush us out. The odds are not looking good. At least the beta-thenatine crash is starting to wear off. I can feel my temperature beginning to climb back toward normal. The surrounding air no longer feels like hot soup, and breathing is ceasing to be the major effort it was when our heart rates were down near flatline. The robot bomb detonates, and the legs of the tank rattle against the hull with a near miss. We both glance reflexively at our exposure meters.
"Bullshit, is it?"
Jimmy peers out of the ragged hole we blew in the spider tank's hull.
"Hey, you're not from there." "I am, and I'm telling you, if they gave me the choice of life on Earth or fucking storage, I'd have to give it some thought." "You get the chance to visit. Don't."
I blinked the glitch away. Above me, the killing knife glinted in its grav field like sunlight through trees. Jimmy was fading out, heading past the knife for the roof.
"Told you not to go there, didn't I, pal? Now look at you. Earth."
He spat and disappeared, leaving the echoes of his voice.
"It's a shithole." Gotta get to the next screen.
The crowd noise had settled down to a steady chanting. The anger ran through the fog in my head like a hot wire. I propped myself up on an elbow and focused on Cadman, waiting on the other side of the ring. He saw me and raised his hands in an echo of the gesture I had used before. The crowd howled with laughter. Get to the next screen. I lurched to my feet. If you don't do your chores, the patchwork man will come for you one night. The voice jumped into my head, a voice I hadn't heard in nearly a century and a half of objective time. A man I hadn't soiled my memory with for most of my adult life. My father and his delightful bedtime stories. Trust him to turn up now, when I really needed the shit. The patchwork man will come for you. Well, you got that wrong, Dad. The patchwork man's standing right over there waiting. He's not coming for me. Have to go and get him myself. But thanks anyway, Dad. Thanks for everything. I summoned what was left from cellular levels in Riker's body and stalked forward. Glass shattered high above the killing floor. The shards rained down on the space between Cadman and myself.
Cadman!
I saw his eyes rise to the gantry above, and then his entire chest seemed to explode. His head and arms jerked back as if something had suddenly thrown him wildly off balance, and a detonation rang through the chamber. The front of his gi was torn off, and a magical hole opened him up from throat to waist. Blood gouted and fell in ropes. I whipped around, staring upward, and saw Trep framed in the gantry window she had just destroyed, eyes still bent along the barrel of the frag rifle cradled in her arms. The muzzle flamed as she laid down continuous fire. Confused, I swung about, looking for targets, but the killing floor was deserted but for the remains of Cadman. Carnage was nowhere in sight, and between explosions the noise of the crowd had changed abruptly to the hooting sounds of humans in panic. Everyone seemed to be on their feet, trying to leave. Understanding hit. Trep was firing into the audience. Down on the floor of the chamber, an energy weapon cut loose, and someone started screaming. I turned, suddenly slow and awkward, toward the sound. Carnage was on fire. Braced in the chamber door beyond, Rodrigo Bautista stood hosing wide-beam fire from a long-barreled blaster. Carnage was in flames from the waist up, beating at himself with arms that had themselves grown wings of fire. The shrieking he made was more the sound of fury than pain. Pernilla Grip lay dead at his feet, chest scorched through. As I watched, Carnage pitched forward over her like a figure made of melting wax, and his shrieks modulated down through groans to a weird electronic bubbling, and then to nothing.
Kovach!
Trep's frag gun had fallen silent, and against the ensuing background of groaning and cries from the injured, Bautista's raised voice was unnaturally loud. He detoured around the burning synthetic and climbed up into the ring. His face was streaked with blood.
"You okay, Kovach?"
I chuckled weakly, then clutched abruptly at the stabbing pain in my side.
"Great. Just great. How's Ortega?"
"She's okay. Got her dosed up on lethanol for the shock. Sorry we got here so late."
He gestured up at Trep. "Took your friend there a while to get through to me at Fell Street.
She refused to go through official channels. Said it wouldn't scan right. The mess we made coming in here, she ain't far wrong."
I glanced around at the manifest organic damage.
"Yeah, not gonna be a problem?"
Bautista barked a laugh.
"Are you ragging me? Entry without a warrant? Organic damage to unarmed suspects? What the fuck do you think?"
"Sorry about that."
I started to move off the killing floor.
"Maybe we can work something out." "Hey."
Bautista caught my arm.
"They took off a Bay City cop. No one does that around here. Someone should have told Cadman before he made the fucking mistake."
I wasn't sure if he was talking about Ortega or me in my Riker sleeve, so I said nothing. Instead, I tipped my head back gingerly, testing for damage, and looked up at Trep. She was reloading the frag gun.
"Hi. You gonna stay up there all night?"
"Be right down."
She jacked the last shell into the frag gun, then executed a neat somersault over the gantry rail and fell outward. About a meter into the fall, the grav harness on her back spread its wings and she fetched up hanging over us at head height, with the gun slung across her shoulder. In her long black coat, she looked like an off-duty dark angel. Adjusting a dial on the harness, she drifted closer to the floor and finally touched down next to Cadman. I limped up to join her. We both looked at the ripped-open corpse in silence for a moment.
"Thanks," I said softly.
"Forget it. All part of the service. Sorry I had to bring in these guys, but I needed the backup and fast. You know what they say about the Shia around here. Biggest fucking gang on the block, right?"
She nodded at Cadman.
"You're going to leave him like that?"
I stared at the right hand of God Martyr with his face shocked into abrupt death, and tried to see the patchwork man inside him. "No," I said, and turned the corpse over with my foot, so that the nape of the neck was exposed.
"Batista, you want to lend me that firecracker?"
Wordlessly, the cop handed me his blaster. I set the muzzle against the base of the patchwork man's skull, rested it there, and waited to feel something.
"Anyone want to say anything?"
Trep cracked, deadpan.
Bautista turned away.
"Just do it."
If my father had any comments, he kept them to himself. The only voices were the cries of the injured spectators, and those I ignored. Feeling nothing, I pulled the trigger. Chapter 37. I was still feeling nothing an hour later when Ortega came and found me in the sleeping hall, seated on one of the automated forklifts and staring up into the green glow from the empty decanting chambers. The airlock made a smooth thump and then a sustained humming sound as it opened, but I didn't react. Even when I recognized her footfalls and a short curse as she picked her way between the coiled cabling on the floor, I didn't look around. Like the machine I was seated on, I was powered down.
"How you feeling?"
I looked down to where she stood beside the forklift. Like I looked, probably.
"Well, you look like shit."
She reached up to where I was seated and grasped a convenient grill cover.
"You mind if I join you?"
"Go ahead. Want a hand up?"
"Nope."
Ortega strained to lift herself by her arms, turned gray with the effort, and hung there with a lopsided grin.
"Possibly."
I lent her the least bruised of my arms, and she came aboard the forklift with a grunt. She squatted awkwardly for a moment, then seated herself next to me and rubbed at her shoulders.
"Christ, it's cold in here. How long have you been sitting on this thing?"
"About an hour." She looked up at the empty tanks.
"Seen anything interesting?"
"I'm thinking."
"Oh."
She paused again.
"You know, this fucking lethanol is worse than a stun gun. At least when you've been stunned, you know you're damaged. Lethanol tells you that whatever you've been through, everything's just fine, and just go ahead and relax. And then you fall ass over tit on the first 5-centimeter cable you try to step over."
"I think you're supposed to be lying down," I said mildly.
"Yeah, well, probably so are you. You're going to have some nice facial bruises by tomorrow. Mercer give you a shot for the pain?"
"Didn't need it."
"Oh, hard man. I thought we agreed you were going to look after that sleeve."
I smiled reflexively. "You should see the other guy."
"I did see the other guy. Ripped him apart with your bare hands, huh?"
I kept the smile. "Where's Trep?"
"Your wirehead friend? She's gone. Said something to Bautista about a conflict of interest and disappeared into the night. Bautista's tearing his hair out trying to think of a way to cover this mess. Want to come and talk to him?"
"All right." I shifted unwillingly. There was something hypnotic about the green light from the decanting tanks, and beneath my numbness, ideas were beginning to circle restlessly. snapping at each other like bottle backs in a feeding spiral. The death of Cadman, far from relieving me, had only touched off a slow-burning fuse of destructive urges in the pit of my stomach. Someone was going to pay for all this. Personal. But this was worse than personal. This was about Louise, alias an enemy, cut up on a surgical platter. About Elizabeth Elliot, stabbed to death and too poor to be re-sleeved. Irene Elliot, weeping for a body that a corporate rep wore on alternate months. Victor Elliot, whiplashed between loss and retrieval of someone who was, and yet was not, the same woman. This was about a young black man facing his family in a broken-down, middle-aged white body. It was about Virginia Vidora walking disdainfully into storage with her head held high, and a last cigarette polluting lung she was about to lose, no doubt to some other corporate vampire. It was about Jimmy DeSoto, clawing his own eye out in the mud and fire at Inanen, and the millions like him throughout the Protectorate, painfully gathered assemblages of individual human potential, pissed away into the dung heap of history. For all these, and more, someone was going to pay. A little dizzily, I climbed down from the forklift and helped Ortega down after me. It hurt my arms to take her weight, but nowhere near as much as the sudden, freezing knowledge that these were our last hours together. I didn't know where the realization came from, but it came with a solid, settling sensation in the bedrock of my mind that I had long ago learned to trust more than rational thought. We left the resleeving chamber hand in hand, neither of us really noticing the fact until we came face to face with Bautista in the corridor outside, and pulled instinctively apart again. "Been looking for you, Kovach." If Bautista had any feelings about the hand-holding, nothing showed in his face. "Your mercenary friend skipped and left us to do the cleaning up." "Yeah, Krista..." I stopped and nodded sideways at Ortega. "I've been told. Did she take the frag gun?" Bautista nodded. "So you've got a perfect story. Someone called in gunfire from the Panama Rose. You came out to look and found the audience massacred. Cadman and Carnage dead. Me and Ortega halfway there. Must have been someone Carnage upset, working off a grudge." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Ortega shake her head. "Ain't gonna scan," Bautista said. "All calls in the Fell Street get recorded. Same goes for the phones and the cruises." I shrugged, feeling the envoy waking within me. "So what? You or Ortega, you've got snitches out here in Richmond, people whose names you can't disclose. Call came in on a personal phone, which just happened to get smashed when you had to shoot your way past the remains of Carnage's security guards. No trace. And nothing on the monitors because the mysterious someone, whoever did all the shooting, wiped the whole automated security system clean. That can be arranged, I take it." Bautista looked dubious. "I suppose we'd need a data rat to do it. Davidson's good with a deck, but he ain't that good." "I can get you a data rat. Anything else?" "Some of the audience is still alive. Not in any fit state to do anything, but they're still breathing." "Forget them. If they saw anything, it was Trep. Probably not even that, clearly. Whole thing was over in a couple of seconds. The only thing we've got to decide is when to call the meat wagons." "Sometime soon," Ortega said, "or it's going to look suspicious." Bautista snorted. "This whole fucking thing looks suspicious. Anyone at Fell Street's gonna know what went down here tonight." "Do this sort of thing a lot, do you?" "That ain't funny, Kovach. Carnage went over the line. He knew what he was calling down." "Carnage," Ortega muttered. "That motherfucker's got himself stored somewhere. As soon as he gets resleeved, he's going to be screaming for an investigation." "Maybe not," Bautista said. "How long ago you reckon he was copied into that synth?" Ortega shrugged. "Who knows? He was wearing it last week. At least that long, unless he had the store copy updated, and that's fucking expensive." "If I were someone like Carnage," I said thoughtfully, "I'd get myself updated whenever something major went down, no matter what it cost. I wouldn't want to wake up not knowing what the fuck I'd been doing the week before I got torched." "That depends on what you were doing," Bautista pointed out.
If it was some seriously illegal shit, you might prefer to wake up not knowing about it. That way, you polygraph your way right out of police interrogation with a smile. Better than that, you wouldn't even... I trailed off, thinking about it. Bautista made an impatient gesture. Whatever. If Connage wakes up not knowing, he might make some private inquiries, but he ain't gonna be in too much of a hurry to let the police department in on it. And if he wakes up knowing... He spread his hands. He'll make less noise than a Catholic orgasm. I think we're in the clear here.
Get the ambulances, then, and maybe call Moraro in to...
But Ortega's voice was fading out as the last part of the puzzle sank snugly into its resting place. The conversation between the two cops grew as remote as star static over a suit comlink. I gazed at a tiny dent on the metal wall beside me, hammering at the idea with every logic test I could muster. Bautista gave me a curious glance, then left to call the ambulances. As he disappeared, Ortega touched me lightly on the arm.
"Hey, Kovac, you okay?"
I blinked.
"Kovac?"
I put out a hand and touched the wall, as if to assure myself of its solidity. Compared to the certainty of a concept I was experiencing, my surroundings seemed suddenly intangible. "Kristen," I said slowly, "I have to get aboard Head in the Clouds. I know what they did to Bancroft. I can bring Kawahara down and get Resolution 653 pushed through. And I can spring Riker." Ortega sighed.
"Kovac, we've been through..."
"No!"
The savagery in my voice was so abrupt it shocked even me. I could feel the bruising in Riker's face hurt as his features tensed.
"This isn't speculation. This isn't a cast in the dark. This is a fact. And I am going aboard Head in the Clouds, with or without your help. But I'm going."
"Kovac,"
Ortega shook her head.
"Look at yourself. You're a mess. Right now you couldn't take on an Oakland pimp. And you're talking about covert assault on one of the West Coast houses. You think you're going to crash Kawahara's security with broken ribs and that face? Forget it."
I didn't say it was going to be easy.
"Kovac, it isn't going to be. I sat on the Hendrix tapes long enough for you to pull that shit with Bancroft, but that's as far as it goes. The game's over. Your friend Sarah gets to go home, and so do you. But that's it. I'm not interested in grudge matches."
"Do you really want Riker back?" I asked softly. For a moment, I thought she was going to hit me. Her nostrils flared white, and her right shoulder actually dropped for the punch. I never knew whether it was the stun gun hangover or just self-control that stopped her.
"I ought to deck you for that, Kovac," she said evenly.
I raised my hands. "Go ahead. Right now I couldn't take on an Oakland pimp, remember?" Ortega made a disgusted sound in her throat and started to turn away. I put out my hand and touched her.
"Kristen,"
I hesitated. "I'm sorry. That was a bitchy crack about Riker. Will you at least hear me through once?" She came back to me, mouth clamped tight over whatever she was feeling, head down. She swallowed.
"I don't... There's been too much..."
She cleared her throat.
I don't want you hurt anymore, Kovac. I don't want any more damage, that's all."
"Damage to Riker's sleeve, you mean?" She looked at me.
"No,"
she said quietly.
"No, I don't mean that. I mean what I say."
Then she was pressed up against me, there in that grim metal corridor, arms wrapped hard around me and face buried in my chest, all without apparent transition. I did some swallowing of my own and held her tightly while the last of what time we had trickled away like grains of sand through my fingers. And at that moment, I would have given almost anything not to have had a plan for her to hear, not to have had any way to dissolve what was growing between us, and not to have hated Raylene Kawahara quite so much. I would have given almost anything. 2 a.m. I called Irene Elliott at the Jack Saul apartment and got her out of bed. I told her we had a problem we'd pay heavily to unkink. She nodded sleepily. Bautista went to get her in an unmarked cruiser. By the time she arrived, the Panama Rose was lit as if for a deck party. Vertical searchlights along her sides made it look as if she was being lowered from the night sky on ropes of luminescence. Aluminum cable incident barriers crisscrossed the superstructure and the dock moorings. The roof of the cargo cell where the humiliation bout had gone down was cranked back to allow the ambulances direct access, and the blast of crime scene lighting from within rose into the night like the glow from a foundry. Police cruisers held the sky and parked across the dock, flashing red and blue. I met her at the gangway.
"I want my body back!"
she shouted over the whine and roar of airborne engines. The searchlights frosted her sleeves, black hair almost back to blonde.
"I can't swing that for you right now,"
I yelled back.
"But it's in the pipeline. First you've got to do this. Earn some credit. Now let's get you out of sight before fucking Sandy Kim spots you."
Local law were keeping the press copters at bay. Ortega, still sick and shaking, wrapped herself in a police greatcoat and kept the local law out with the same glitter-eyed intensity that kept her upright and conscious. Organic Damage Division, shouting, pulling rank, bullying, and bluffing, held the fort while Elliot went to work faking in the monitor footage they needed. They were indeed, as Trepp had recognized, the biggest gang on the block.
"I'm checking out of the apartment tomorrow," Elliot told me as she worked. "You won't be able to reach me there."
She was silent for a couple of moments, whistling through her teeth at odd moments as she keyed in the images she had constructed. Then she cast a glance at me over her shoulder.
"You say I'm earning juice from these guys doing this. They're going to owe me?"
"Yeah, I'd say so."
"Then I'll contact them. Get me the officer in charge. I'll talk to whoever that is. And don't try to call me at Ember. I won't be there either."
I said nothing, just looked at her. She turned back to her work.
"I need some time alone,"
she muttered. Just the word sounded like a luxury to me. Chapter 38. I watched him pour a drink from the bottle of 15-year-old malt, take it to the phone, and seat himself carefully. The broken ribs had been welded back together in one of the ambulances, but the whole of that side was still one huge ache with occasional flinty stabs of agony. He sipped at the whiskey, gathered himself visibly, and punched out the call.
"Bancroft residence, with whom do you wish to speak?"
It was the severely suited woman who had answered last time I called Suntouch House. The same suit, the same hair, even the same makeup. Maybe she was a phone construct. "Miriam Bancroft," he said. Once again, it was the sensation of being a passive observer, the same sensation of disconnection that I had felt that night in front of the mirror while Riker's sleeve put on its weapons, the frags. Only this time it was much worse.
"One moment, please."
The woman disappeared from the screen and was replaced by the image of a wind-blown match flame in sync with piano music that sounded like autumn leaves being blown along a cracked and worn pavement. A minute passed, then Miriam Bancroft appeared, immaculately attired in a formal-looking jacket and blouse. She raised one perfectly groomed eyebrow.
"Mr. Kovach, this is a surprise."
"Yeah, well..." He gestured uncomfortably. Even across the comlink, Miriam Bancroft radiated a sensuality that unbalanced him. "Is this a secure line?"
"Reasonably so, yes. What do you want?"
He cleared his throat.
I've been thinking. There are some things I'd like to discuss with you. I may owe you an apology."
"Indeed."
This time it was both eyebrows.
"When exactly did you have in mind?"
He shrugged. "I'm not doing anything right now."
"Yes. I, however, am doing something right now, Mr. Kovach. I am en route to a meeting in Chicago, and will not be back on the coast until tomorrow evening."
The faintest hint of a smile twitched at the corners of her mouth.
"Will you wait?"
"Sure."
She leaned toward the screen, eyes narrowing.
What happened to your face?
He raised a hand to one of the emerging facial bruises. In the low light of the room, he had not expected it to be so noticeable, nor had he expected Miriam Bancroft to be so attentive. Long story. I'll tell you when I see you.
Well, that I can hardly resist,
she said ironically.
I shall send a limousine to collect you from the Hendricks tomorrow afternoon. Shall we say about 4 o'clock? Good. Until then.
The screen cleared. He sat, staring at it for a moment, then switched off the phone and swiveled the chair around to face the window shelf. She makes me nervous, he said. Yeah, me too. Well, obviously. Very funny. I try. I got up to fetch the whiskey bottle. As I crossed the room, I caught my reflection in the mirror beside the bed. Where Riker's sleeve had the air of a man who had battered his way headfirst through life's trials, the man in the mirror looked as if he would be able to slip neatly aside at every crisis and watch fate fall clumsily on its fat face. The body was cat-like in its movements, a smooth and effortless economy of motion that would have looked good on Ancona Salamau. The thick, almost blue-black hair fell in a soft cascade to the deceptively slim shoulders, and the elegantly tilted eyes had a gentle, unconcerned expression that suggested the universe was a good place to live in. I had been in the Tech Ninja sleeve only a few hours. 7, and 42 minutes according to the time display chipped into my upper left field of vision, but there were none of the usual download sound effects. I collected the whiskey bottle with one of the slim brown artist's hands, and the simple play of muscle and bone was a joy that glowed through me. The Kumalo Neurochem system thrummed continually at the limit of perception, as if it were singing faintly the myriad possible things the body could do at any given moment. Never, even during my time with the Envoy Corps, had I worn anything like it. I remembered Carnage's words and mentally shook my head. If the UN thought they'd be able to impose a 10-year colonial embargo on this, they were living in another world. I don't know about you, he said, but this feels fucking weird. Tell me about it. I filled my own tumbler and proffered the bottle. He shook his head. I went back to the window shelf and sat back against the glass. How the fuck did Cadman stand it? Ortega says he used to work with himself all the time. Get used to anything in time, I suppose. Besides, Cadman was fucking crazy. Oh, and we're not? I shrugged. We didn't have a choice. Apart from walking away, I mean. Would that have been better? You tell me. You're the one who's going up against Kawahara. I'm just the whore around here. Incidentally, I don't reckon Ortega's exactly overjoyed about that part of the deal. I mean, she was confused before, but now... She's confused? How do you think I feel? I know how you feel, idiot. I am you. Are you? I sipped at my drink and gestured with the glass. How long do you think it takes before we stop being exactly the same person? He shrugged. You are what you remember. Right now we have only about 7 or 8 hours of separate perceptions. Can't have made much of a dent yet, can it? On 40-odd years of memory? I suppose not. And it's the early stuff that builds personality. Yeah, they say. And while we're on the subject, tell me something. How do you feel, I mean, how do we feel, about the patchwork man being dead? I shifted uncomfortably. Do we need to talk about this? We need to talk about something. We're stuck here with each other until tomorrow evening. You can go out if you want. Come to that. I jerked a thumb upward toward the roof. I can get out of here the way I came in. You really don't want to talk about it that badly, huh? Wasn't that tough? That, at least, was true. The original draft of the plan had called for the ninja copy of me to stay at Ortega's apartment until the Riker copy had disappeared with Miriam Bancroft. Then it occurred to me that we'd need a working relationship with the Hendricks to bring off the assault on Head in the Clouds, and that there was no way for the ninja copy of myself to prove its identity to the hotel, short of submission to a storage scan. It seemed a better idea for the Riker copy to introduce the ninja before departing with Miriam Bancroft. since the Riker copy was undoubtedly still under surveillance, at the very least, by Trepp, walking in through the front door of the Hendricks together looked like a very bad idea. I borrowed a grav harness and a stealth suit from Bautista, and just before it started to get light, I skimmed in between the patchy high-level traffic and down onto a sheltered flange on the 42nd floor. The Hendricks had by this time been advised of my arrival by the Riker copy and let me in through a ventilation duct. With the Kamala Nurikem, it had been almost as easy as walking in through the front door. "Look," the Riker copy said, "I'm you. I know everything you know. What's the harm in talking about this stuff? If you know everything I know, what's the point of talking about it? Sometimes it helps to externalize things. Even if you talk to someone else about it, you're usually talking to yourself. The other guy's just providing a sounding board. You talk it out." I sighed. "I don't know. I buried all that shit about Dad a long time ago. It's a long time dead." "Yeah, right. I'm serious." "No." He flicked a finger at me the way I had pointed at Bancroft when he didn't want to face my facts on the balcony of Suntouch House. "You're lying to yourself. Remember that pimp we met in Laszlo's pipe house the year we joined Shenagan's 11? The one we nearly killed before they pulled us off him? That was just chemicals. We were off our head on tetramath, showing off because of the 11 stuff. Fuck, we were only 16. "Bullshit. We did it because he looked like Dad." "Maybe." "Fact. And we spent the next decade and a half killing authority figures for the same reason." "Oh, give me a fucking break. We spent that decade and a half killing anyone who got in the way. It was the military. That's what we did for a living. And anyway, since when is a pimp an authority figure?" "Okay, maybe it was pimps we spent 15 years killing. Users. Maybe that's what we were paying back." "He never pimped Mom out." "Are you sure? Why were we so hot to hit the Elizabeth Elliot angle like a fucking tactical nuke? Why the accent on whorehouses in this investigation?" "Because," I said, sinking a finger of whiskey, "that is what this investigation has been about from the beginning. We went after the Elliot angle because it felt right. Envoy intuition. The way Bancroft treated his wife." "Oh, Miriam Bancroft. Now there's another whole disc we could spin." "Shut up. Elliot was a pretty fucking good sounding shot. We wouldn't have got to head in the clouds without that trip to Jerry's bio cabins." "Ah." He made a disgusted gesture and tipped his own glass back. "You believe what you want. I say the patchwork man's been a metaphor for Dad because we couldn't bear to look too closely at the truth. And that's why we freaked the first time we saw a composite construct in virtual. Remember that, do you? That wreck house on Adoracion? We had rage dreams for a week after that little show. Waking up with shreds of pillow on your hands. They sent us to the psychs for that." I gestured irritably. "Yeah, I remember. I remember being shit scared of the patchwork man, not Dad. I remember feeling the same when we met Cadman in virtual, too." "And now he's dead. How do we feel now?" "I don't feel anything." He pointed at me again. "That's a cover." "It is not a cover. The motherfucker got in my way. He threatened me, and now he's dead. Transmission ends." "Remember anyone else threatening you, do you? When you were small, maybe?" "I'm not going to talk about this anymore." I reached for the bottle and filled my glass again. "Pick another subject. What about Ortega? What are our feelings on that score? Are you planning to drink that whole bottle?" "You want some?" "No." I spread my hands. "So what's it to you? Are you trying to get drunk?" "Of course I am. If I've got to talk to myself, I don't see why I should do it sober. So tell me about Ortega." "I don't want to talk about that." "Why not?" I asked reasonably. "Got to talk about something, remember? What's wrong with Ortega?" "What's wrong is that we don't feel the same about her. You aren't wearing Riker's sleeve anymore." "That doesn't..." "Yes, it does. What's between us and Ortega is completely physical. There hasn't been time for anything else. That's why you're so happy to talk about her now. In that sleeve, all you've got is some vague nostalgia about that yacht and a bundle of snapshot memories to back it up. There's nothing chemical happening to you anymore." I reached for something to say and abruptly found nothing. We sat in silence, studying the amber depths of our glasses. The suddenly discovered difference sat between us like a third, unwanted occupant of the room. The Riker copy dug into his pockets and came up with Ortega's cigarettes. The pack was crushed almost flat. He extracted a cigarette, looked ruefully at it, and fitted it into his mouth. I tried not to look disapproving. "Last one," he said, touching the ignition patch to it. "The hotel probably has more."
"Yeah."
He plumed out smoke, and I found myself almost envying him the addiction. "You know, there is one thing we should be discussing right now."
"What's that?"
But I knew already. We both knew. "You want me to spell it out?"
"All right."
He drew on the cigarette again and shrugged, not easily. "We have to decide which of us gets obliterated when this is all over. And since our individual instinct for survival is getting stronger by the minute, we need to decide soon."
"How?"
"I don't know. Which would you prefer to remember? Taking down Kawahara? Or going down on Miriam Bancroft?" He smiled sourly. "No competition, I suppose." "Hey, this isn't just a role on the beach you're talking about. This is multiple copy sex. It's about the only genuinely illicit pleasure left. Anyway, Irene Elliott said we could do a memory graft and keep both sets of experience."
"Probably. She said we could probably do a memory graft, and that still leaves one of us to be canceled out.
It's not a meld, it's a graft, from one of us to the other. Editing. You want to do that to yourself? To the one that survives? We couldn't even face editing that construct the Hendrix built. How are we going to live with this? No way, it's got to be a clean cut, one or the other, and we've got to decide which."
"Yeah."
I picked up the whiskey bottle and stared gloomily at the label. "So what do we do? Gamble for it? Paper, scissors, stone, say the best of five?" I was thinking along slightly more rational lines. We tell each other our memories from this point on, and then decide which we want to keep. Which ones are worth more.
How the hell are we going to measure something like that?
We'll know. You know we will.
What if one of us lies? Embroiders the truth to make it sound like a more appealing memory. Or lies about which one they like better.
His eyes narrowed.
Are you serious?
A lot can happen in a few days. Like you said, we're both going to want to survive.
Ortega can polygraph us if it comes to that.
I think I'd rather gamble.
Give me that fucking bottle. If you're not going to take this seriously, neither am I. Fuck it, you might even get torched out there and solve the problem for us.
Thanks. I passed him the bottle and watched as he decanted two careful fingers. Jimmy DeSoto had always said it was sacrilege to sink more than five fingers of single malt on any one occasion. After that, he maintained, you might as well be drinking blended. I had a feeling that we were going to profane that particular article of faith tonight. I raised my glass.
To unity of purpose.
Yeah, and an end to drinking alone. The hangover was still with me nearly a full day later as I watched him leave on one of the hotel monitors. He stepped out onto the pavement and waited while the long, polished limousine settled to the curb. As the curbside door hinged up, I caught a brief glimpse of Miriam Bancroft's profile within. Then he was climbing in, and the door swung smoothly back down to cover them both. The limousine trembled along its length and lifted away. I dry-swallowed more painkillers, gave it 10 minutes, and then went up to the roof to wait for Ortega. It was cold. Chapter 39. Ortega had a variety of news. Irene Elliott had called in a location and said she was willing to talk about another run. The call had come in on one of the tightest needle casts Fell Street had ever seen, and Elliot said she would only deal directly with me. Meanwhile, the Panama Rose patch-up was holding water, and Ortega still had the Hendrix memory tapes. Cadman's death had rendered Fell Street's original case pretty much an administrative formality, and no one was in any hurry to tackle it anymore. An internal affairs inquiry into how exactly the assassin had been pulled out of holding in the first place was just getting started. In view of the assumed AI involvement, the Hendricks would come under scrutiny at some point, but it wasn't in the pipeline yet. There were some interdepartmental procedures to be gone through, and Ortega had sold Marawa a story about loose ends. The Fell Street captain gave her a couple of weeks open-ended to tidy up. The tacit assumption was that Ortega had no liking for internal affairs and wasn't going to make life easy for them. A couple of IAD detectives were sniffing around the Panama Rose, but organic damage had closed ranks around Ortega and Bautista like a stack shutdown. IAD was getting nothing so far. We had a couple of weeks. Ortega flew northeast. Elliot's instructions vectored us in on a small huddle of bubble fabs clustered around the western end of a tree-fringed lake, hundreds of kilometers from anywhere. Ortega grunted in recognition as we banked above the encampment. You know this place?
Places like it. Grifter Town. See that dish in the center? They've got it webbed into some old geosync weather platform. Gives them free access to anything in the hemisphere. This place probably accounts for a single-figure percentage of all the data crime on the West Coast.
They never get busted?
Depends.
Ortega put the cruiser down on the lakeshore a short distance from the nearest bubble fabs.
The way it stands, these people keep the old orbitals ticking over. Without them, someone would have to pay for decommissioning, and that's kind of pricey. So long as the stuff they turn over is small scale, no one bothers.
Transmission Felony Division has got bigger disks to spin, and no one else is interested. You coming? I climbed out, and we walked along the shoreline to the encampment. From the air, the place had a certain structural uniformity, but now I could see that the bubble fabs were all painted with brightly colored pictures or abstract patterns. No two designs were alike, although I could discern the same artistic hand at work in several of the examples we passed. In addition, a lot of the fabs were fitted out with porch canopies, secondary extension bulges, and in some cases even more permanent log cabin annexes. Clothing hung on lines between the buildings, and small children ran about, getting cheerfully filthy. Camp security met us inside the first ring of fabs. He stood over 2 meters tall in flat work boots, and probably weighed as much as both my current selves put together. Beneath his loose gray coveralls, I could see the stance of a fighter. His eyes were a startling red, and short horns sprouted from his temples. Beneath the horns, his face was scarred and old. The effect was startlingly offset by the small child he was cradling in his left arm. He nodded at me.
You Anderson?
Yes. This is Kristen Ortega. I was surprised how flat the name suddenly sounded to me. Without Riker's pheromonal interface, I was left with little more than a vague appreciation that the woman beside me was very attractive in a lean, self-sufficient way that recalled Virginia Vidora. That, and my memories. I wondered if she was feeling the same.
Cop, huh?
The ex-freak fighter's tone was not overflowing with warmth, but it didn't sound too hostile either. Not at the moment, I said firmly. Is Irene here?
Yeah.
He shifted the child to his other arm and pointed.
The fab with the stars on it. Been expecting you.
As he spoke, Irene Elliott emerged from the structure in question. The horned man grunted and led us across, picking up a small train of additional children on the way. Elliott watched us approach with her hands in her pockets. Like the ex-fighter, she was dressed in boots and coveralls, whose gray was startlingly offset by a violently colored rainbow headband.
Your visitors, the horned man said. You okay with this?
Elliot nodded evenly, and he hesitated a moment longer, then shrugged and wandered off with the children in tow. Elliot watched him go, then turned back to us.
You'd better come inside,
she said. Inside the bubble fab, the utilitarian space had been sectioned off with wooden partitions and woven rugs hung from wires set in the plastic dome. Walls were covered in more artwork, most of which looked as if it had been contributed by the children of the camp. Elliot took us to a softly lit space set with lounging bags and a battered-looking access terminal on a hinged arm, epoxied to the wall of the bubble. She seemed to have adjusted well to the sleeve, and her movements were smoothly unself-conscious. I'd noticed the improvement on board the Panama Rose in the early hours of the morning, but here it was clearer. She lowered herself easily into one of the loungers and looked speculatively up at me.
"That's you inside there, Anderson, I presume."
I inclined my head.
"You going to tell me why?"
I seated myself opposite her. "That depends on you, Irene. Are you in or out?"
"You guarantee I get my own body back?"
She was trying hard to sound casual, but there was no disguising the hunger in her voice.
"That's the deal?"
I glanced up at Ortega, who nodded.
"That's correct. If this comes off successfully, we'll be able to requisition it under a federal mandate. But it has to be successful. If we fuck up, we'll probably all go down the double barrel."
"You are operating under a federal brief, Lieutenant?"
Ortega smiled tightly.
"Not exactly. But under the UN Charter, we'll be able to apply the brief retrospectively, if, as I said, we are successful."
"A retrospective federal brief?"
Elliot looked back at me, brows raised.
"That's about as common as whale meat. This must be something gigantic."
"It is," I said. Elliot's eyes narrowed.
"And you're not with Jaxall anymore, are you? Who the fuck are you, Anderson?"
"I'm your fairy godmother, Elliot. Because if the lieutenant's requisition doesn't work out, I'll buy your sleeve back. That's a guarantee. Now, are you in or are you out?" Irene Elliott hung on to her detachment for a moment longer, a moment in which I felt my technical respect for her take on a more personal tone. Then she nodded.
"Tell me,"
she said. I told her. It took about half an hour to lay it out, while Ortega stood about or paced restlessly in and out of the bubble fab. I couldn't blame her. Over the past 10 days, she'd had to face the breakdown of practically every professional tenant she'd owned, and she was now committed to a project that, if it went wrong, offered a bristling array of 100-year or better storage offenses for all concerned. I think, without Bautista and the others behind her, she might not have risked it, even with her cordial hatred of the Meths, even for Riker. Or maybe I just tell myself that. Irene Elliott sat and listened in silence, broken only by 3 technical queries to which I had no answers. When I was finished, she said nothing for a long time. Ortega stopped her pacing and came to stand behind me, waiting.
"You're insane,"
Elliott said finally. "Can you do it?" She opened her mouth, then shut it again. Her face went dreamy, and I guessed she was reviewing a previous dipping episode from memory. After a few moments, she snapped back and nodded as if she might be trying to convince herself.
"Yes,"
she said slowly.
"It can be done. But not in real time. This isn't like rewriting your Fightdrome friend's security system, or even downloading into that AI core. This makes what we did to the AI look like a systems check. To do this, to even attempt this, I've got to have a virtual forum."
"That's not a problem. Anything else?"
"That depends on what counter-intrusion systems Head in the Clouds is running."
Disgust and an edge of tears colored her tone for a couple of instants.
"You say this is a high-class whorehouse?"
"Very," Ortega said. Elliot's feelings went back underground.
"Then I'll have to run some checks. That'll take time."
"How much time?" Ortega wanted to know.
"Well, I can do it 2 ways.
Professional scorn surfaced in her voice, scarring over the emotion that had been there before.
"I can do a fast scan and maybe ring every alarm aboard this prick in the sky. Or I can do it right, which'll take a couple of days. Your choice. We're running on your clock."
"Take your time," I suggested, with a warning glance at Ortega. "Now, what about wiring me for sight and sound? You know anyone who can do that discreetly?"
"Yeah, we got people here can do that. But you can forget a telemetry system. You try to transmit out of there, you will bring the house down. No pun intended."
She moved to the arm-mounted terminal and punched up a general access screen.
I'll see if Reese can dig you up a grab-and-stash mic. Shielded microstack. You'll be able to record a couple of 100 hours high-res, and we can retrieve it here later.
Good enough. This gonna be expensive? Elliot turned back to us, eyebrows raised.
Talk to Reese. She'll probably have to buy the parts in, but maybe you can get her to do the surgery on a retrospective federal basis. She could use the juice at UN level.
I glanced at Ortega, who shrugged exasperatedly.
I guess, she said ungraciously, as Elliot busied herself with the screen.
I stood up and turned to the policewoman. Ortega, I muttered into her ear, abruptly aware that in the new sleeve I was completely unmoved by her scent. It isn't my fault we're short of funds. The Jaxall account's gone, evaporated. And if I start drawing on Bancroft's credit for stuff like this, it's gonna look fucking odd. Now get a grip.
It isn't that, she hissed back.
Then what is it? She looked at me, at our brutally casual proximity.
You know goddamn well what it is.
I drew a deep breath and closed my eyes to avoid having to meet her gaze. Did you sort out that hardware for me?
Yeah.
She stepped back, voice returning to normal volume and empty of tone.
The stun gun from the Fell Street tackle room. No one will miss it. The rest is coming out of NYPD confiscated weapon stocks. I'm flying out to pick it up tomorrow personally. Material transaction, no records. I called in a couple of favors.
Good. Thanks.
Don't mention it.
Her tone was savagely ironic.
Oh, by the way, they had a hell of a time getting hold of the spider venom load. I don't suppose you'd care to tell me what that's all about, would you?
It's a personal thing. Elliot got someone on the screen. A serious-looking woman in a late-50s African sleeve.
Hey, Reese, she said cheerfully. Got a customer for you.
Despite the pessimistic estimate, Irene Elliott finished her preliminary scan a day later. I was down by the lake, recovering from Reese's simple microsurgery, and skimming stones with a girl of about 6 who seemed to have adopted me. Ortega was still in New York, the chill between us not really resolved. Elliott emerged from the encampment and yelled out the news of her successful covert scan without bothering to come down to the water's edge. I winced as the echoes floated out across the water. The open atmosphere of the little settlement took some getting used to, and how it fitted in with successful data piracy I still couldn't see. I handed my stone to the girl and rubbed reflexively at the tiny soreness under one eye, where Reese had gone in and implanted the recording system.
Here, see if you can do it with this one. Your stones are heavy, she said plaintively.
Well, try anyway. I got 9 skips out of the last one. She squinted up at me.
You're wired for it. I'm only 6.
True. On both counts. I placed a hand on her head. But you gotta work with what you got.
When I'm big, I'm gonna be wired like Auntie Reese.
I felt a small sadness well up on the cleanly swept floor of my Kamala Nurikam brain. Good for you. Look, I've gotta go. Don't get too close to the water, right? She looked at me exasperatedly.
I can swim.
So can I, but it looks cold, don't you think?
Yes.
There you are, then. I ruffled her hair and set off up the beach. At the first bubble fab, I looked back. She was hefting the big flat stone at the lake as if the water were an enemy. Elliot was in the expansive post-mission mood that most data rats seem to hit after a long spell cruising the stacks.
I've been doing a little historical digging, she said,
swinging the terminal arm outward from its resting place. Her hands danced across the terminal deck, and the screen flared into life, shedding colors on her face.
How's the implant?
I touched my lower eyelid again. Fine. Tapped straight into the same system that runs the time chip. Reese could have made a living doing this.
She used to,
Elliot said shortly.
Till they busted her for anti-protectorate literature. When this is all over, You make sure that someone puts in a word for her at federal level, because she sure as shit needs it.
Yeah, she said. I peered over her shoulder at the screen. What have you got there?
Head in the clouds. Tampa Air Yard.